Thank you very much, Rabbi. Usually, those of you who attend lectures that I give, whether it's on Yerushalayim or Eretz Yisrael or in Chumash, usually I try to make those discussions or lectures educational in nature. Tonight, I'd like to make it a little different. I'd like certainly to have some educational elements to it, but I also would like this evening to be observational. Not just my observations, by the way. I would like to invite you into a discussion. The discussion is on the very topic that we say, the title of our topic is Har HaBayit Biyadeinu, right? And of course, we know who uttered that, Rabbi Shlomo Goren and the troops who, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's chesed, liberated Yerushalayim from the Jordanians. So we all either can remember because we heard it, or we can rejoice because we hear the recording, Har HaBayit Biyadeinu. The Temple Mount is in our hands. So tonight we have to ask, is it? We are seeing a relentless onslaught to deprive the Jewish people of its natural homeland in general, to deny, just recently, one of a prime decision by the United Nations to deprive Har HaBayit of any semblance of Jewish character. It is called Haram HaSharif. It is called the Noble Sanctuary. That's what the Arabs refer to it as. Even the Kotel, which seemed to be off limits to their tentacles in terms of the way the world is now being directed to look at it, it is no longer that. It is the Barak hall, or the wall. And so the sanctity of Har HaBayit is being stripped of any element of Jewish sanctity. Yehuda Glick, for example, I personally admire him very much. I don't know that I can talk about the halachic ramifications of going on to Har HaBayit. Far, far, far greater scholars than I have dealt with the issue. Most of them have concluded the Jews should stay off of Har HaBayit. Some have stated that one can go with certain parameters, to be very careful where you go. I must confess, I don't know those parameters. I couldn't tell you where you can and where you can't go. But I know that the world despises Yehuda Glick. The world despises any attempt of Jews simply to assert not even an exclusive right to Har HaBayit. Simply to be able to say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, and not only that, we can see that we'll be coming to a point where they'll even deny us the right to be able to say that. Going back to the at the Kotel itself, going back to the days of the British mandate, where literally Jews had to ask permission to daven. And then, of course, they weren't allowed to blow shofar, etc., etc. So we are seeing a receding of a time when the world rejoiced. Those of us who had the great zechut of living through those magnificent moments 49 years ago. 49 years ago, this coming Yom Kafchet Iyar, Yom Yerushalayim, we'll never forget. The joy, and the world rejoiced with us. The world rejoiced with us. But now we are seeing a terrible backsliding. So one must ask first and foremost, Har HaBayit Biyadeinu, really? What does it mean to be Biyadeinu in our control? Certainly our troops can be there, but the idea of being able to see that it is Harabait itself, of course, is also devoid of any religious influence other than Islam. And of course, when we see what's going on college campuses and the direct assault upon Jewish sovereignty on the soil of Eretz Yisrael, not to mention Yerushalayim, not to mention Harabait, is something which I must tell you is quite depressing. I worry personally from the standpoint, as I told you, observations. We'll be seeing some things and talking about some things, but I worry more than I worry about Iran, although I do, but I'm no military person, so if they told me Iran is a pussycat, I'd believe them. If they told me Iran, you know, is the worst regime in the world, I can believe them, because I don't know. But I do know this, that in my estimation, the greatest threat is not going to be from Iran, it's not going to be from Hamas. It is our own internal struggles that we are going through. The issues that are going on with gender issues at the Kotel, the fighting that is going on, and if not necessarily physical, certainly in terms of the turmoil that's going on with the Jewish community, the failure to recognize each other, the failure to talk with each other, all of these things bode very poorly. And when we look at one more element, I hope I can bring a brighter side to this too, but when I look at the current presidential race, what is there to choose? It used to be, I must say, that I would say, all right, and I remember Reb Herzl Kaplan, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. Anybody who had the zechut of knowing Reb Herzl is a person who is very fortunate. I remember when Nixon and Humphrey were the candidates for president, 1968. I was in the yeshiva in 1968, and I said, Rebbe, what are we going to do? What happens if Nixon wins? And Reb Herzl told me the following. It's true. Humphrey, who was the Democrat at the time, said, it's true. Humphrey is a great, great Ohev Yisrael. Truly, he was a person who loved the Jews and who was an honest and good man through and through. He said, that's true. But if he loses, this was just before the election, it looked like he was going to lose, he says, Nixon will be all right too. Because Nixon doesn't like the Jews. But Nixon knows he needs Israel. And because of that, strategically, Nixon will support us. I'm not worried. And that lack of fear on the part of Reb Herzl was borne out. He was a man of tremendous perceptivity. He could look at situations and draw conclusions. Can we say the same thing now? I've come to the conclusion in my own mind, to be honest with you, that this is the only election I can honestly say that no matter who wins, I can say with a certain sense of satisfaction, at least the other one didn't. But there's a big problem here. And we don't know that either. Neither of them has a sterling record regarding Israel. I don't want to get into, you know, each of the individual candidates. Neither has a sterling record. One has certainly an unknown record. The other, even if one would claim is in favor of Israel, the company she keeps is scary. When we look at the plane of the Democrat Party now, it's very scary. And the fact that Senator Sanders now has such a big say in what the platform will be, and he has clearly come out to tell people how he feels foreign policy should be. We must ask the question, Harabayit biyadeinu, Eretz Yisrael biyadeinu. So times are very difficult for us. Every day when we daven, every day, we say, Tehillim Kuf Men Zayin, which Chazal identify as being part of the essence of Hallel. Kuf Men Zayin is the second parak after Ashrei. It begins, Halleluka, Ki Tov Zamra Elokeinu. It is wonderful, it is good to sing to Hashem. Ki Naim Navatila, because praise is becoming. And then David HaMelech said, Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem. Hashem builds Yerushalayim. Notice, When you think about it, our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, they all said this phrase, Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem, and they did not have any idea that we would come to this magnificent time in which Yerushalayim certainly is physically right now in our hands. It's in jeopardy, but it's in our hands. But our great-great-grandparents said, Bonei, as if it's happening now. Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem. And then the next phrase is, Yidchei Yisrael Yichanes. The dispersed people of Israel, he will gather. Now, all of that is beautiful. And that this is a statement by David HaMelech, of course, that the true builder of Yerushalayim is the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that Yerushalayim itself will be the catalyst through which Nidchei Yisrael Yichanes. He will gather the ingathering of the Jewish people. I must tell you, I had the remarkable, unbelievable schus of being in Eretz Yisrael in 1991 during the first Gulf War. I like to refer to it as the big one, but it was. Anybody else been there? Were you there at that time? Yeah, okay. So you know that it was a very scary time. Very scary time. The Scuds would come, and I remember the very first time that Saddam Hussein, Yimach Shemo, sent the Scuds. You know, it's very clear. He said, if the United States attacks him, so he'll attack Israel, as if there any connection. All right? And they said to us, don't go, the State Department said. We advise, so there was an advisory. By the way, that's exactly what the country should do, exactly for its citizens. But of course, we all have business. It said, unless you have business in Israel, we all have business in Israel. So I went as scheduled. And I will never forget the first night, 1 o'clock in the morning, it was actually 2 o'clock in the morning, in Yerushalayim, in HaKodesh, I was in Yerushalayim. All of a sudden, we heard that distant siren as if it was a dream. If you remember, it was like it was waking you from a sleep, a deep sleep, because you were sleeping. 2 o'clock in the morning, I got up and I said, this is no test here at 2 a.m. So we ran up to the top floor, because the whole idea was in case the Scud had chemical weapons on it, so the chemicals are heavier than air. So the whole idea is you go up to the third, fourth, fifth floor, whatever you can, and then hopefully whatever chemicals there will at least gone down back to Earth. And if we all had to put on our gas masks, etc. And I remember we turned on the radio, because that's what we were to do, and they said, we are broadcasting in 7 languages, Mipnei Kibbutz Am Yisrael Aretz, because of the ingathering of the Jewish people. So they dictated in consecutively 7 languages, Russian and Yiddish and English and Hebrew and French, I remember all of the English, whatever, 7 languages. Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem Nidchei Yisrael Yichanes. That was the absolute embodiment of it. By the way, parenthetically, I'll tell you a quick story that I had there. I went to rent a car. Okay, so I go to rent a car, and of course the whole world was traumatized by what was going on. My wife realized okay, you can go, and but we thought it over long and hard. So I went to rent a car, and I said to the guy, trying to put on my brave face, I said, well, what happens if there's an attack? You know, Scotty says, don't worry. He said, and by the way, Chiloni Lagamri, completely Chiloni, secular Jew, nice guy, wonderful. So I said to him, what do I do? He says, what are you worried about? He says, this is Israel. You knock on a door, they'll let you in. Oh, okay. No, he didn't. Right? So he said, fine, okay. But then I started to walk away. I said, well, what happens? What happens, let's say, if I'm not real close? He said, well, then you drive up to find a Yerushalayim. Go up on a high place. Chances are everything will be fine. He said, anyway, chances are it's not going to happen. So I said, okay. And then I said to him, well, what happens if I'm not near a hill I can't get a house. What do I do? And let's say I'm in the open road. So here's the chiloni. He looks at me. See, he says to me in Hebrew, "Ani ayiti mitpalel." I doubt it. He meant it. Yeah, I think he did mean it. So, but Now, but here's the next part of this pasuk that I want to talk to you about. Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem Nitchei Yisrael Yichanes, Harofei Lishvurei Lev, who heals the brokenhearted, Umchabesh La'atzvotam, and he binds their wounds. That, we say that every day. And I must tell you, for years and years, I said, I don't understand the connection. All right, all of those statements are true, but the juxtaposition of them, that David chose to do that, that I guess. Until this last year, I understand. HaKadosh Baruch Hu builds Yerushalayim, and when he builds Yerushalayim, people come, as you're going to see, the Yerushalayim, since 1967, all right? Since 1967, Yerushalayim has grown fourfold, okay? Since, with Hashem's chesed, our soldiers liberated Yerushalayim, it has grown fourfold, from 262,000, almost fourfold, to 804,000, it really is, okay? Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem. Nitchei Yisrael Yichanes, they're all coming. But what's the Harofei Lishvurei Lev? And we now know. The attacks in Yerushalayim. All the people who are mourning. All the people who are brokenhearted. The people who died in bus stops and the people who died just walking the streets and the Chayalim Hashem should protect them every day. That stand guard over the Jewish people. There's lots of brokenhearted people. Chazal tell us the word atzvotam etzev does not mean physical infirmity. It means their emotional, psychological pain. Hashem will bind it. And Yehi Ratzon, may it be that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the same HaKadosh Baruch Hu about whom we say Bonei Yerushalayim, and we mean it, not Yivneh, Bonei Yerushalayim, on a daily basis, HaKadosh Baruch Hu builds Yerushalayim. Okay? Nidchei Yisrael Yechanes, and he does that on a daily basis. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant a nechama to those who mourn, and may grant speedy healing to those who suffer both emotionally and physically from the trauma that they have gone through. Okay. June 7th, 1967, Koach Iyar, right? The 28th day of Iyar, Tafshin Chav Zayin, 57-27. Okay, as I told you, Yerushalayim then had about 240,000 people. Anybody, I want this to be a little more interactive too. Does anybody know what the percentage was in 67 of Jews to Muslims in the country? And if you're anybody willing to venture a guess, I won't laugh no matter what the guess is.
You're talking about Israel or Jerusalem?
Yeah, Jerusalem. Oh, not Israel. Just Jerusalem itself.
Oh, just in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm.
In 1967? What would you think?
Three to one? The old city and the new city.
Yeah, yeah, united. Old city, new city.
I'd say 2-1.
2-1, two Jews, two to one.
Arabs.
2-1 Arabs.
And 3-1 Arabs.
3-1 Arabs. Well, it turns out the reality is in 1967, I'm going to pass this out to you so you can see. And we're going to, oh my, I don't know whether we have enough, Rabbi. So we'll share. This actually is, you can just pass it out. This is not hard to get. I just actually did some Google work and did it for you. In 1967, the ratio of Jews to Muslims, 74% Jews, 21% Muslims. 74-21. And then there were Christians too. By the way, the Christian population has remained stable. Apparently, in the last couple of years, it's actually gone up a little bit, even though there are other reports that say that it's declining. It probably depends which of the Christian populations we're talking about. But that's what it was in 1967. 20 years later, by 1987, the population was 474,000, 71% Jews, 25% Arabs. 1995. 600, look how steadily Yerushalayim, Eretz Kodesh, is growing. 417,000 Jewish people, Kanai Nohara. 67% Jews, 29% Arabs. 2011, by the way, it hasn't changed that, the composition hasn't changed that much since 2011. 801,000 Jewish people altogether, nearly, it's really 499,000 now, Jews, 62% Jewish. 35%. Muslim. What does that tell you? Anybody?
We can't afford the prices.
Okay, all right, yeah, but right. But you can see, of course, what's happening is that the ratio of Jews to Muslims in Yerushalayim, that includes both the what was originally under Jordanian hands and which is now ours, and you knew Yerushalayim, there is a steady decline in terms of, there's a steady increase in terms of population, Jewish population, but a steady decline in terms of relations. So David says that that it is because it's so expensive to live there. Yeah? Mm-hmm. What? Lots of young people can't live there now. That's very true. And therefore, concomitant with that is what is happening. There are now Haredi communities, for example, that are growing up outside of Yerushalayim. Many young people who get married now, let's say they are in a Haredi community setting, or as we will see, Mizrahi as well, they now immediately look for their first home outside of Yerushalayim, in Beitar, in Kiryat Sefer, in many, many other small locations. Now, by the way, Beitar is not a small location, I've got to tell you. There's 40,000 Jews, all Jews, living in Beitar. Now, there's only 107 families, but there's 40,000. But nevertheless, I'm proud to say my children are keeping up that ratio very well. But the reality is Jews, young people, are moving quickly to other areas they're not choosing, whereas the Palestinians and the Muslims are not. Another contribution to, if that's the case, and you have the Haredi community, which is the fastest growing community in Eretz Israel, the Haredi community. It's the fastest growing community in Eretz Israel. As you can see, in Yerushalayim itself, 32% of Yerushalayim identifies itself as Haredi. 21% is religious, but it means to say Mizrahi generally, Mizrahi, or modern Orthodox. What?
Is that like modern Orthodox?
Yeah, modern Orthodox or Mizrahi, which would be, of course, nationalist.
What? Same thing.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Kipas Ruga, Nachum. Right. Good. 10% identify themselves as traditional, not necessarily Shomer Shabbat in the fullest sense, but Shabbat is Shabbat for them. Kashrut, generally they keep, they're just not necessarily as scrupulous as others might be. And then you have 19 or 1 out of every 5 Jews living in Yerushalayim identifies as secular. Okay? So we can see that, again, and of course, Yerushalayim is also known as the poorest of the big cities in Eretz Israel. And why? Look at, yeah, again, you should know. By no means, I love every Jew. I got to tell you, number one. Number two, one thing I always tell my students, there's no right or wrong way here. What one group contributes, the other doesn't. What another group contributes, that one doesn't. Because the reality is that each group, if we would remove any of these groups, certainly if we would remove Mizrahi, we would remove Dati Leumi, but whether it be Haredi or others, what happens is the Jewish people is impoverished by that. And so what we have to do is say, all right, if I am a modern Orthodox Jew, I have to look and see what do they contribute to Klal Yisrael that I or my group does not as much. And if so, I have to try to adopt that. And I think that's really important to know. But one thing is certain. Haredim, generally speaking, they're going a little more to college now than they were, but they're still far from it, so that the high-tech jobs and other jobs which are going to be in the near future going to become the mainstay of of life, they're going to be small shop owners, they're going to be small business owners, etc. That's not where the big money is, and if there's not big money, then there's not big taxes. If there's not big taxes, city services are not strong. So that in itself, there are certainly a number of problems that we have in terms of Yerushalayim, And this is just the demographics. It's something that we have to look at and consider. We're down to 62% Jews and 35% Arabs. And roughly, again, the Christian community has remained stable, more or less. Okay. Now I'd like to present another thing to you. Here is the big issue. Remember when they first started talking about Oslo, so they would talk about, they had three or four issues that they felt had to be dealt with. Did everybody seem to agree that the last issue to be on the table is Jerusalem? Because it is the most difficult. Now, here's what I'm going to ask you. To what degree is it a religious issue? It would seem obvious, no? To us, it's very religious. And we can't tell them what's religious in their faith. It's pointless. If they say Yerushalayim is Al-Quds, which means the holy city, so I can't say, no, it's not to you like that. That's pointless to say that. We determine what is Kodesh to us. They determine what's Kodesh to them. But I would submit to you the issue of Yerushalayim is not nearly as religious as it is money. That's what makes the world go round. And I would submit to you that even if, by some magical, mystical nace, a Palestinian leadership would come along and they would say, look, here, let's just live together in peace. We're going to put down our lives and we're going to show you. We're going to get guarantees. We're going to get internet. I'm going to everything. All right? Yeah, okay? Here's the thing, though. We want Yerushalayim. And what would we say?
Absolutely.
Is there anybody who would say yes? Interesting. What would happen if we said to the Arabs, Palestinians, look, here, but we've got all this whole great consortium that we're going to get together. You're going to, and in other words, we will work it out. The only thing is, and there'll be peace. The only thing is, we get all of Yerushalayim. And what will they say?
No.
Why?
No.
It doesn't have to do with religion. Money. Can you imagine? Come to Palestine and visit beautiful Ramallah. There's nothing beautiful about Ramallah. There's whenever, again, I forget the fact that it was in the city. There's nothing beautiful. People, when they think of Israel or, quote, Palestine, what's there? Damas. And they say, that's what's there. So I would submit to you that there will never be a peace agreement in which one or the other will get all the joy. That's not going to happen. Because, again, they couldn't possibly have a state without the most important tourist attraction in that whole area. What do you think?
They already turned it down once.
What?
They turned it down once.
Yeah, well, that's...
In Iraq, they had 97% of what they wanted, including most of the old city, and it turned down.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I mean, they've already tried it, and...
It's not going to work. So, in other words, what we're really saying, though, is they're probably... For absolutely the foreseeable future, there will be no peace agreement. Because they're not going to say, okay, we'll give up Yerushalayim. I don't think so. They turned down the peace treaty with Yerushalayim because they didn't get other things as well. So they want the whole pie, so they couldn't. And also, when Arafat turned it down, but even later when it was turned down by Abbas, it was turned down, certainly with Arafat's, because he didn't know how to run a state. All of a sudden, he was confronted with the idea that he might actually have a state. He had no clue how to run it. And so, therefore, he turned it down. And Abbas is in no position to make any decisions at all. So I really don't think there's going to be any peace.
It's about the economics and the money.
Mm-hmm.
When I was first there in the 70s, I probably spent as much money in the Arab Shuk and the tourists going through the Arab Shuk and handling this. That was a big economic boom. Yeah. But when things got bad in terms of being able to walk through the Arab Shuk, the local Arabs, they took a big hit.
Yeah, I agree with you. Absolutely. The only thing is, guaranteed, I shouldn't speak for you, but guaranteed for me, the reason I went to Yerushalayim, or the reason I went to Israel is Yerushalayim, Once I was there, I went to the Arab Shuk. Sure, in those days it was a lot more peaceful. We bought things there. You know, yeah, that's true. But I don't think you planned your trip around saying, "I can't wait to get to the Arab Shuk." Right? Okay, because that's the way it is. Yerushalayim is the attraction for all of the Western world, and the country that has it is going to have a gold mine. The country that doesn't have it will remain impoverished. They'd have to, unless they can come up with some unbelievable scheme. So that's why I don't envision. Yeah.
But
yes.
Jordan had the old city of Yerushalayim for 19 years and nothing. More accommodating to tourism.
Yeah. Yes, I agree with you again. But remember, we're talking about the Palestinians, Jordan is a relatively big country. I mean, it's not big, but I mean, relative to everything else. Here, all the Palestinians will have is this sliver of land. By the way, I'm not making the case the Palestinians should get Yerushalayim. I'm just simply saying that the Palestinians themselves are going to need some form of major income. And, you know, aside from Yerushalayim, there just isn't much. Maybe Christians would, if they would get the Upper Galilee or part of it, maybe. Bethlehem, maybe.
They have a casino and...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think you're being too kind. Because all this idea of them wanting income and all stuff in Gaza, and they destroyed the possibility of an income.
Oh, yeah.
And I think also another reason that we can't get back to Yerushalayim is a strategic reason. Just because they say they want to make peace, well, I don't think we can...
No, right. I agree. But see, I'm agreeing a lot, but what I'm saying is that absolutely that's true. Absolutely, that's true. But I think in the end, when it comes to the wheelers and dealers in politics, the first thing they want to know is where's the money? And outside of Yerushalayim, what has Israel done? We've developed high tech. We've developed startup, you know, businesses so much. We've done all of that, Baruch Hashem. And that will keep, they haven't. There's not much hope that they will. And so they need what they think is a cash cow. And I think that's why all of a sudden Yerushalayim is so important to them. It wasn't important to them before. Do you know that that even as late as 1910, the Arab population, there more than 50% of the population was Jewish? All right, 1910. So if the Arabs really cared about Yerushalayim, they had control, the Ottomans, etc., nope, moved there. So Yerushalayim, there's only one reason for them to want Yerushalayim. And I shouldn't say only one. Their primary reason is money. And what they do is they stir up religion among the masses as saying that, you know, they're going to take Al-Aqsa, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I think. I'm not sure. But now, I'm going to distribute something,
which is also depressing.
If you thought you were coming for a good time here. This, I thank Rev Eisenberg for running this off, because without color, it won't work. This is generally what Yerushalayim looks like today. Actually, this is from about 6 years ago, but the reality is it doesn't change a whole lot. There are some new Jewish neighborhoods, maybe there might be an Arab neighborhood or so, but basically what you're looking at is as follows. All of that red, all of the red, is Palestinian territory with virtually no Jews at all in it. You can see, you know, in the lower right-hand corner, you see Abu Dis, okay, and other strongholds of completely Muslim Palestinian. The pink, which is inside the border, you know, you can see the black border which is there, those are under the control of the municipality of Yerushalayim, but the pink is primarily Muslim Palestinian neighborhoods. Okay? Now, Israel has full security control there. They also, but where, as opposed to the red, where the security is left up to the Palestinians, but Israel reserves the right to engage in operations as is necessary to protect the Israeli population. Anything which is dark blue or light blue is Jewish. And then, in the where you see that checkerboard, Western Jerusalem, that's what Yerushalayim looked like before on June the 4th, shall we say, 1967. So that's, for example, in Western Jerusalem, that would be Har Nof, that would be Beit Vegan, that would be Rehavia, all the places that we know that are there. Okay. So when you see the pink, as you can see, the old city there is in the middle. So it's certainly surrounded. The only blue there is the Iratika, is the Rova Yudi. Other than that, it's primarily Arab, Palestinian. So aside from the fact that we're not going to be able to, on ideological or monetary grounds, economic grounds, we're not going to see a division, you can see how difficult it would ever be to divide Yerushalayim. Whether it be a physical division or a security division, whatever it may be, we're not looking at anything in the near future at all that I can think of, unless, God forbid, it's imposed upon us. If it's imposed, who knows what resistance has to take place. And like I say, I don't know what's going to be in November. What will happen in November? And then, of course, the following January. We don't have any clearly good indication from any of the candidates or the people who can exert most influence on them as to how things go. And that's why you've seen probably the flurry of articles that Israel is talking. They're thinking of the Arab peace plan, and they're thinking of the Saudi peace plan, and Sisi with Egypt. There is a rapprochement of some sort where they are working together on other things, and that may come together in a peace conference. Netanyahu has rejected the Paris plan. Of course, when you call the Kotel in Hamaravi, you call it an Arab site, and then you want to sit at a peace plan. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And I think that incorrectly they say, no, we're not doing that. So you can also see, the checkerboard is Mount Scopus, even in the middle there. That was a stronghold it was a Jewish stronghold until 1967 when Baruch Hashem was liberated from the Arabs. So this gives you a bit of an idea of how difficult it would be anyway to find some degree of separation. What we mean is separation, we mean in terms of sovereignty. Now you see at the top and the bottom, you see Ramallah and Beit Lechem, that's under the full control of the Palestinian Authority. And that with but rare exceptions, Israel respects that those areas, if for no other reason, it's just maybe not worth the struggle. All the other areas, of course, they go in pretty much at will, and they perform nightly raids. So this is usual. Okay, we have a couple minutes. I just want to conclude with something you may have heard in the past, and it is, I think, it has bearing upon us and the issue of Yerushalayim. You know, Amos Oz, who is Israel's most famous, probably is Israel's most famous author, writer, a man of extraordinary skill at writing, far to the left, grew up on kibbutz, and he wrote in 1978, he wrote a book, a selection of his essays, which is called Be'or HaTechelet HaAza, in the light of the bright, strong blue. Here's what he writes about Eretz Israel, his conception of Israel and the Jewish people. The land of Israel could not be born, nor could it exist anywhere but on this spot, not in Uganda, nor Ararat, nor in Birobidzhan. Birobidzhan was a sector in Russia which was offered temporarily to the Jews to live and have some degree of autonomy. But it couldn't be in any of these places, because it was to this place that Jews turned their hearts in every generation. Regarding this, I must make a serious, almost cruel distinction between the internal motivations of the return to Zion and its justification to other people. The yearnings of the generations are motivations, not justification. Political Zionism made a political tool out of religious messianic yearnings, properly so. But our justification as regards the Arab populace of the land cannot rely upon our yearnings throughout the generations. What do they care about our yearnings? There is no objective justification. This is the key. There is no objective justification for the Zionist enterprise beyond the right of a drowning man to grab the only plank in the sea available to him. That justification is sufficient. So Amos Oz is Zionism, and by the way, Amos Oz is a very influential man, certainly in the left-wing circles of Israel. The justification of the Jewish state is because there's nowhere else. But it is the right of a drowning man to grab onto the plank. But what happens if there are two or three or four drowning men, or perceived drowning men? They all have to move over. That is a, especially some people call it post-Zionism, you call it what you want, but it in itself is another reason that, that another cause for some pessimism. The idea is we all have to live together, and the idea of having a idealistic state, a Zionistic state, where of course even Hatikva is threatened to some degree by many Jews there.
Haredim.
No, I'm not even talking about the Haredim. I'm talking about the left wing. The Haredim certainly have never done. I agree. All right? But the idea of, they object to, the Haredim object to Hatikva because God's name isn't mentioned. These people reject Hatikva because the whole Zionist enterprise is false. That's different. That's different. Now, that's Amos Oz. I'm going to counter that with a statement of Rav Kook. Rav Kook said the following: Eretz Yisrael is not something apart from the soul of the Jewish people. It is no mere national possession, serving as a means of unifying our people and buttressing its material or even its spiritual survival. Eretz Yisrael is a part of the very essence of our nationhood. It is bound organically, that's the key word. It is bound organically to its very life and inner being. When we talk about an organism, what do we mean? I can't say I have a hand and it's not me. My hand is I. My arm is I. It's organically tied to me. So we have on the one hand an Amos Oz approach, which is, look, we needed a place to go, we're there. Now move over, let some other people in. And there's Cook's view, which certainly is that which has inspired tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, that this is organically the Jewish people's. And by the way, it's not a possession. You hear what Rav Kook said? Eretz Israel is not the possession of the Jewish people. It is the Jewish people. It is bound organically to us. We are bound organically to it. That's different than being a possession. And now I'm going to just conclude with a statement Rav Kook made about Yerushalayim. He said this, by the way, he wrote this in about 1918 or so. He passed away in 1935. He wrote, he says, I wish to reveal to you today the existence of a new movement. And he calls it HaTnu'ah HaYerushalmit, the Jerusalem movement. It was, Rav Kook, by the way, did formulate it. Eventually he had to backtrack, but he formulated it as an alternative to the standard Zionist movement, secular Zionist movement. Hinenu Korim B'Shem Yerushalayim, the Yerushalmiyut. He said, I'm calling it Yerushalayim and Yerushalmiyut because if we speak about, as he calls it, Shebetriyatenu Halumit, our national renaissance, K'shem Shehinenu Korim B'Shem Tzion, Tzioniyut, Just as we call in the name of Zion, we call it Zionism. And what is Zionism, he says? This is the Tzad HaChol Shelah. This is the non-sacred form of the Jewish people. That would be to say, he calls it Tzad HaChol Shelah. That's what Zionism represents, the material element of the Jewish people. That's what chol is, after all. Chol is sand, the material part of the Jewish people. He says, V'im degel Yushalayim narim. But if we could take Tzionut, which seeks to revive the physical being of the Jewish people, and combine it with Yerushalayim, which is the embodiment of the spirituality of the Jewish people, he said, then indeed we are coming closer to the establishment of the time of Mashiach. So he looks upon Yerushalayim as in itself the representative of the spiritual being of the Jewish people, whereas Tzionut is representation of the bodily and the material welfare of the Jewish people. And of course, with this, I'm going to say, make one more statement of Rav Kook about, in general, Eretz Yisrael, and then we'll conclude if there's any comments people want to make. Rav Kook, of all of the Gedolei Yisrael, had the most fully created philosophy of all of them. It dealt with everything, not just sitting and learning, although that's extremely important. Not just going to the army, that's extremely important. Not just business, that's extremely important. Listen to what he writes. Tzrichim lo'orer tchiyat Yisrael b'chol hakochot. We must arouse the renaissance of the Jewish people with all the power within us. Kol Torata, with all of the Torah. V'chol emunata, with all of our faith. V'chol miroteha, with all of our character. V'chol tova, with every good element that we have. V'chol oshra, with all of our material wealth. B'chol kocha, with all of our physical wealth. B'chol hegyon teha, with all of our thinkers. B'chol shirata, with all of our poets. B'chol otzma, with all of the strength. B'chol chum chaya, with all of the vibrancy of its life. If we are to see Mi'ertz Hashem and Eretz Israel, Yerushalayim and Eretz Israel, which will last for decades and decades, then we must harness all of the power within the Jewish people. Not only just learning, not only just this element or that element, but it must be Israel in its entirety. I'll conclude with one thing. My daughter once called me. I was in Israel at the time. She was in Israel. She was in seminary. And she met some people who said, what did the Zionists do? They didn't do anything. It's the soldiers that have done everything. Right? I mean, it's the people who are learning Torah that did everything. What do the Zionists do? So my daughter was very troubled. She called me up. She was actually in tears. What do I tell these people? So I said, tomorrow we're going on a field trip. I said, bring your sitter. We're going on a field trip. I took her to Har Herzl. She with her sitter, I with my sitter. And there we looked out on that vast cemetery, with all of the graves of the precious people, as Rav Auerbach called them, the tzaddikim of the Jewish people, all laying at rest, 18 years old, 19 years old, 22 years old, 24 years old. And I said to her, pick a grave, any grave, stand by it, say a Perek of Tehillim, put your stone on there, and then utter the words, thank you. And I must say that every time we go to Eretz Yisrael now, we do, as a family, we don't go to the Kotel first. We don't go to even Shul first and let's us mincha or something. We go, maybe coming late, next morning, before we go anywhere. We go to our Herzl as a family. We bring our stones. We bring our sidurim. We pick a different section of that cemetery and we place a stone on the grave and we say Tehillim and a Kel Mole and then we say thank you. That's what we have to do. We have to thank Hashem every day. We have to thank Achayalim every day for their bravery and our dear friends and relatives who make such great sacrifices to live on the soil of Eretz Israel and in Yerushalayim. Okay, thank you. Thank you. No questions? Any comments or questions? Yeah. Shlomo, yeah.
I think, with all due respect, your approach is very Western. I think the idea is money.
Okay.
I think, though, that the real problem is an Arab irredentism, Islamic irredentism. And historically, whatever has been conquered, because as Bernard Lewis says, Islam is an engine of conquest. Anything that has been conquered as Arab land or Muslim land must stay Arab land. So when the PLO arose in 1964, before 67, it was an irredentism to remove the Jews from, you know, the land.
Yeah, I agree. That's
every
true.
Time the Jews, the Arabs rejected agreements, it goes back to a certain rejectionism, an irredentism that is built in to their culture.
I would submit Zev Zegorim. I would submit to you, first of all, many, there are Arab leaders who do not share that religious fervor, but they live in a religious atmosphere, even if they wanted to give it up. They couldn't. That's
see, I would say differently. I would say the only time that there are agreements is where the Arabs understand, or the Muslims understand, they can't go forward. The whole reason why the last great great Muslim empire was stopped, it was stopped militarily in Vienna, and it waned. They realized they couldn't go forward. Mm-hmm. But we haven't given the Arab mindset, or the Muslim mindset, that they can't go forward because we don't fight to win.
Okay, I hear you, I hear you. Any other comments? But I will not fight to win. All right. Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Reverend Myers.